Yes, I'm talking about things to do with the interplay between quantum mechanics and general relativity. Different subjects, separate from each other, both 20th century discoveries, amazing each. What about the interrelation between the two? That's the mystery which I want to talk about. Now, much work has been done on trying to what's called quantize general relativity, much of it using things like Feynman diagrams and so on. So this picture is meant to be showing how these things are meant to be sort of Feynman diagrams in the middle there, which is it, within the framework of quantum mechanics, trying to get the grips of general relativity. So it's using that, which is fine if you want to scatter gravitons against each other and things like that, which is not terribly much relevant to things. But on the other hand, if you want to talk about black holes and things like that, it probably doesn't help too much. Anyway, there's lots of activity going on in this area. How about the other way? There is work in curved space, trying to do general relativity in curved space-time, which is there a fair theory about. Perhaps the most successful was Stephen Hawking's black hole temperature and entropy and evaporation. But on the whole, this is also a stopgap kind of theory because you don't really have any back reaction to explain how curvature gets modified. So let's not do those two, which are basically one of them trying to impose on the other, and think more about the union between the two. Well, there's a lot of work on various people's ideas, string theory, loops, foams, various ideas like this. Sure, one's trying to find basic theory which unifies quantum mechanics and general relativity, but it's enormously far from anything which might have experimental consequences. I'm concerned with things which we do see experiments, or we're maybe not far from seeing experiments. So it's that kind of thing I'm going to talk about. Do we see aspects of combining quantum mechanics with general relativity which relate to observational things? Okay, now here's a picture. On the right-hand side, we see what lots of people have tried to use quantum mechanics for in general relativity. That represents the singularities. You see at the top, a sort of cartoon of collapsing black hole or something, and you have a mess of a singularity at the end. On the left-hand side, well, this is my sort of cartoon of a cat which is half dead and half alive. So this is the problem, basic problem in quantum mechanics. Well, there are other problems where you've got lots of infinities and things. That's true. In quantum field theory, many things just diverge on you. You have to have tricky ways of getting rid of the divergences, which are sometimes good, sometimes bad. But the main problem I want to talk about is, in fact, the problem of the what's called the measurement problem. So the poor little half-dead, half-cat, half-alive cat, which is on the left-hand side, is what I shall be talking mainly about. Okay, on the other hand, the question of singularities, let me make a point about that. There is an issue which I regard as very important. Most people don't seem to pay much attention to. The question really is, could space-time singularities be resolved by quantum gravity or something like that? I used to think so myself, just like everybody else, but I was led to believe that if it's a quantum gravity phenomenon, it's got to be a mighty peculiar kind of theory, which is grossly asymmetrical in time, because the evidence we have is that the singularities in black holes are utterly different from the singularity in the Big Bang. Even though in the early singularity theorems, well, I had my theorem on the singularities in black holes, and then Stephen Hawking picked up and concentrated much more on the Big Bang to try to show that this was generic. You couldn't get around the Big Bang by having, say, some previous eon, something or other, which was collapsing and then swirled around in some complicated way and then burst out again. So these things don't work unless you have some radical change in, well, maybe it's quantum gravity of some sort. But you see, the trouble I have is that the bio curvature seems to go wild and go to infinity in the singularities that we expect to occur in black holes, whereas the vial curvature, the conformal curvature, that is, seems to go to zero or something like it in the Big Bang. So we have a very, very different situation for those two types of singularities. Let me just make this a bit more graphic. Here we have a cartoon of the picture that we have of the cosmology as we understand it. The Big Bang at the bottom, time is going up my pictures usually. And so you see the, I'm not trying to say the universe is closed, you might think it is, but if you look at the back, it goes all sorts of wibbly things happening, so it may not close at the back. I'm not trying to prejudice the issue as to whether it's spatially closed or not. It doesn't make any difference to most of these discussions. So it's easy to draw it if it's sort of closed for a bit. That's why I'm drawing it this way. Now, there is this issue at the beginning, which seems to be much of modern cosmology, is this thing called inflation. I have to say, I was never happy with inflation. I never believed it. It does do things which you need to have other explanations for if you don't have inflation. I'll come to a little bit of that later on, not too much, because that's not the main topic I want to discuss. But what about the Big Bang? What about the inflation, where you see something which looks again like an exponential expansion? So it's a little bit like the future that we see now, see the turn of the century, we seem to see this, what people call dark energy. I was very worried by that term because I used to go to conferences and they kept saying, well, maybe by the next conference, we will know the sign of the whether there's a cosmological constant and what its sign is. But then as soon as they actually found that it had a positive sign, they don't call it that anymore. So I found that a little disturbing. Nevertheless, as far as we know, the exponential expansion is fully consistent with the presence of a positive cosmological constant of Einstein's theory. But people like to have the another stage, which is also inflationary, and this is for reasons to do with the cosmic microwave background. But I want to point out that the similarity between the picture that people seem to want to have in the early universe and the exponential expansion that we see in the remote future. I should say that one of the things it doesn't do, which people seem to think, is that it smooths out the universe. It certainly does not smooth out the universe. And there is one clear reason why I can see that. Let's move to the next slide. You see, suppose we think of the time reverse, we have a collapsing universe. And suppose it's got irregularities in its black hole form and all that sort of thing. Then you're going to get some great mess at the end, nothing like that smooth case where the black holes all congeal with each other and vial curvature goes completely wild and singular. And maybe you have things like the Belinsky-Lyachev-Kolatnikov situation on Mizner, where you have wildly diverging and complicated interplay between things, which is nothing like the time reverse of what the Big Bang seems to be like. In other words, we don't see that. And this is all tied up with the second law of thermodynamics, which I worried about a lot. You see, at the top of these three pictures, well, the top three, we see a gas in a box, which is initially sort of trapped in one corner, and then you open the box and it spreads out through the box. And that represents ordinary matter increasing entropy, spreads out and looks more and more uniform. Whereas in the case of gravity, you imagine there's a lot of stars gravitating to each other. On the bottom left, you see a lot of stars pretty well smooth out distribution. And then as time progresses, they clump and clump and clump. So in both cases, from left to right, you're seeing the increase of entropy, but you see in a very, very different behavior. And what one seems to see in the early universe is a combination of top right and bottom left. So it's very, very strange that the entropy is very low in the gravity, whereas very high in everything else. And this is also confirmed by the microwave background. You see this very close fitting with the microwave thermal spectrum. So let's move on. I'm always puzzled by that. I won't say too much about it here, but I was finally led to a picture largely through my former student and now professor, well, now retired. That's what's happened to my students. So I realized I reached a great age when all of my students have retired. pretty well the case now. Anyway, Paul Todd had a much nicer way of saying, you see, I like to say as a hypothesis, maybe for some reason unknown, the viral curvature has to vanish at the Big Bang. And I hope that this might come out of some very strange kind of time asymmetric quantum gravity theory. I just don't think that's the way of right way of looking at it. The right way of looking at it is to adopt more the picture that Paul had, was to think of the conformal expansion of the Big Bang and the formal compression of the remote infinity, since we have apparently a cosmological constant of dark energy, whatever you call it, that leads to the conformal compression of that being space-like surface, and the conformal expansion of the Big Bang is naturally a space-like surface. But the idea is that it's a smooth surface. And Paul's idea was that the hypothesis you postulate, just a postulate, was that it's smooth and that you can continue it perhaps to some imaginary pre-Big Bang thing, which you don't take seriously apart from mathematically. But my idea was to take it seriously and to regard this as the continuation of the remote future of what I call a previous eon. So this thing in the middle is our eon, and our remote future will become the Big Bang of the next eon. Our Big Bang was the conformal compression of an eon prior to ours. You can only get away with this if for some reason the physics at both ends becomes in some sense conformally invariant. Well, if we think of the remote future being dominated by photons, photons are conformally invariant. Maxwell's equations don't know whether they don't know big from small, and you can stretch or squash, and the equations non-uniformly stretch and squash, and the Maxwell equations don't see anything. Of course, we have other material. You have hydrogen and all sorts of things in the remote future. I have to make a postulate that, in fact, there is a mechanism whereby mass gradually fades out in the very remote future. That's a hypothesis which I have to make. There are some reasons to expect something like this, but for the moment, we just say it regards as a hypothesis. What about the Big Bang? Well, there the case is much stronger, because there you have a very hot and concentrated situation. And because the particles are moving around so fast, their kinetic energy completely dominates their mass, the mass becomes irrelevant. And so in effect, in the limit, as you go back into the Big Bang, you do have in effect a conformal, well, lack of anything which determines the scale. So the conformal geometry is a good thing to study. And physically it makes sense. You might think it doesn't. You might say, why is this very rarefied and cold remote future anything light like the very hugely dense and hot Big Bang? Well, you see, when you conformally squash the remote future, then the temperature goes up. When you conformally stretch the Big Bang, the temperature comes down. And when you do both those things, you find they're very similar. And so the idea is actually to postulate that they are similar and that our Big Bang was the continuation of the remote future of the previous eon. So it's not quantum gravity. So this was the thing which lots of my friends, I guess, who work on quantum gravity might be irritated with me, because I'm saying, well, no, there is no quantum gravity to explain the Big Bang. It's not quite true. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. What about observational things? I said, well, we have to think about observations. At first, I lectured about the conformal cyclic cosmology model, which I've just shown you, trying to say, well, thinking nobody will ever prove me wrong, so I can go on lecturing on it forever. However, then I thought about things, well, maybe you could prove me wrong, because here's a cartoon of, you see, the rectangular thing in the middle, this red thing in the middle, is the join between the previous eon and our eon. So it's where our Big Bang joins on to the remote future of the previous eon. And here we have a couple of supermassive, super-duper-massive black holes colliding into each other, and then another one. So say a cluster of galaxies, and a collision and another collision. You might have several of them before there becomes one single dominating black hole in that cluster of galaxies. And as we look back, you see, gravitational waves are massless, and so in a certain sense, they do get through from one side to the other. And you would expect to see rings, the intersection of our cone and these future cones there would look like a ring in the sky. And maybe you would see concentric rings. I've tried to draw them in the bottom of the picture, rather faint, because they are rather faint. But nevertheless, well, my colleague Vahe Gurzajan looked for them by looking for low variance rings, because you would expect the temperature around the ring to be of anomalously low variance. That's not quite a strong enough signal, but if you look for at least three of them with the same center, that was strong enough to see something. And this is his map of the Planck data, which I find very striking. What we see, I should say that the color coding is that the red ones are the warm ones and the blue ones are the cool ones. So that's the wrong way around from physics point of view. But it's also the wrong way around because the red ones actually, according to the theory, are the more distant ones. Because the way the thing works, that they are the blue shift, the blue shifted ones are the more distant ones and the red shifted ones are closer. You have to look at the way the thing works to see that. But you see at the top right, you have a collection of super duper cluster of galaxies, apparently, according to what we're proposing anyway, which is within our eon. The one at the bottom is outside our eon. Our light cone extends outside what we call our particle horizon. And so you can actually see, in theory, things which are outside our horizon. And the claim here is this red collection there isn't, these represent the centers of these rings, where at least three of them. And they're low variance, so you're not singling them out from the temperature. What's striking is not just the clumping of the signals, but the fact that it's clumped also in color, which means, in the theory, that what you're looking at things which are clumped physically together. That is to say, the bottom right collection would be, according to the theory, a super duper cluster of galaxies, and the one up at the top right would be a nearer super duper cluster of galaxies, not so big, closer, the one the bottom right would be more distant. But why is it not uniform? Whatever the source of these signals, according to current theory, you'd expect it to spread uniformly over the sky. So I find this very striking, not that it's just a confirmation of the ideas which I've been putting forward, nobody seems to pay any attention to it, but that whatever it is that's producing this signal is so non-uniform, which is a bit striking. I wasn't expecting to see that, but it does seem and indicate that in some sense, although the universe is very uniform, as far as the black hole concentrations are concerned, according to at least this picture, it's not as uniform as one might have thought. The other signal that we claim we see is the evidence for the evaporation of supermassive black holes. So you get these super duper massive black holes, which will be in clusters of galaxies. They will probably last for something like a Google years, 10 to the 100, maybe 10 to the 103 years, according to Don Page. That's a long time, but the concentration will be very, see, all the mass of this thing comes out in Hawking evaporation. There may be a little bit at the end comes out in something else, but that doesn't make much difference. Even if it's not true that there's Hawking evaporation, you still get the effect which I'm trying to indicate, which is, now here's a picture from a paper published just last year in the summer by myself, Christoph Meisner, Pavel Nirovsky, two Poles, and Daniel Ann, who is a Korean who lives in New York, and he did all the numerical part of the analysis. Christoph had the idea of how to do the analysis. And let me explain this picture. This is meant to be a picture locally of the crossover surface. This is the bottom horizontal surface. That is the join between one eon and the next, according to the theory. This little line coming in from the bottom of this underneath is the world line of a supermassive black hole. The entire evaporation of that supermassive black hole will be more or less concentrated in a tiny point. Since it comes out so late, it's really concentrated in a point. So that entire mass energy of that black hole bursts through in the form of energy. Now that energy, according to the scheme, would spread out. You wouldn't see it. It would mainly probably photons. It would be spread out through this cone, which is the next horizontal line you see above that is decoupling or whatever you like to call it, all these different things, decoupling or last scattering, which are more or less in the same place in the conformal picture. But the spreading out would be to about 8 times the diameter of the moon. So what you would see would be a spreading out, a sort of spot of warming And the warming is of something about an order of magnitude greater than the general range of temperature variations. And at the top, you see a rough sketch of the sort of Gaussian shape of that, with the spread of that to about 4 degrees, or eight times the diameter of the moon, or a bit less, depending upon when. You see, here at the top right, you see an observer looking back at this thing and not seeing directly at the Hawking point. I'm calling this thing at the bottom a Hawking point. That's the total Hawking evaporation squashed into one point. And the point G is the same point later on, 380,000 years later, when the radiation starts to get out. You might not see it quite head on, so you might not quite see it at 4 degrees across. So it might be slightly less than eight times the diameter of the moon. But the more off you see it, the fainter it would be. So that gives you a general feeling. And we apparently see these things, these spots in the microwave background. In the Planck data, the analysis showed the existence of these spots was with a confidence level of 99.8% confidence level, 99.98% confidence, sorry, 99.98% confidence level. Exactly where these spots are is not with such a confidence level, but you can see where the most prominent of these spots are. And in fact, the five most prominent of these spots are to be seen not only in the Planck data, but in the WMAP data also, the earlier satellite, in exactly the same places. So I think that's pretty good, strong evidence that they're real. There is another one in the Planck, in the WMAP data, which is almost as strong in the WMAP data, a little weaker in the Planck data, but also at the same place. So we see those six points, which I think are pretty strong evidence that they are there, whatever the reason for them. Somebody else might have an explanation for, but there's a clean explanation from the point of view of the conformal cyclic picture. I didn't really want to say too much about that. I've probably gone on too long about that, because that's not really the main point of the talk. The main point of the talk is the other side of this picture, the quantum mechanics problem, and not the infinities of the problem. I'm not addressing that, which is certainly a problem with the way we treat quantum mechanics when we're looking at relativistic quantum mechanics. I'm talking about the most basic problem, which is the Schrödinger cat problem. In other words, the reduction of the quantum state. Now, this is a nice quote from John Bell. It's a question about, for all practical purposes. I mean, he says, well, maybe you can get away with assuming that the wave function collapses or something or other through environmental decoherence or something like that, which doesn't really do it, but nevertheless, for all practical purposes. And then he says, perhaps when we have a theory beyond FAP, as he calls it, there may be, well, maybe something to do with the mind of the observer or to the Hindu scriptures or to God, or perhaps even gravity. Wouldn't that be very interesting? Well, I'm following up on the gravity idea. And the main point I want to talk about with regard to gravity is the principle of equivalent. This is the foundation stone of gravity. Here we have on the left hand, upper left, we have Galileo, or somebody, if he never really did it himself, but he imagined doing it, Galileo dropping a big rock and a little rock. And of course, an insect on the big rock would look as though the little rock was hovering without any gravity. And the bow, we have a bottom picture, we have a space traveler with a sort of 2001 space station there. And again, doesn't, even though the Earth is right there, of course, doesn't feel any, you see differences between the gravity, if you like, but there's no direct feeling of the gravitational force. Okay, now suppose we are now imagining a quantum mechanic on the tabletop. So here we have a tabletop with a, we're just doing a quantum experiment and we're working out the wave function. And we could do this in two different ways. Probably what most physicists would do was simply slam a term into the Lagrangian, into the Hamiltonian to represent the potential for the gravitational field and just chug away in the normal way and just do normal quantum mechanics. I'm just assuming a uniform gravitational field, which is what you would normally do if you were trying to consider the gravitational field there. But then if you see Einstein sort of sitting in the corner, you have to say, whoops, maybe we should be using his point of view. That is to say, okay, there is no gravitational field, but you simply use a freely falling frame. And then you compare one to the other, and what do you get? You almost get the same answer. Why do we say almost? Well, the purple one is the Einsteinian frame, freely falling, and so you don't see any gravitational field. The green one is the Newtonian frame, and you see that the purple one is related to the purple wave function is related to the Newtonian wave function by merely a phase factor. So you could say, well, who cares? We're going to square the modulus, the phase factor eventually to work out amplitudes and thing, work out probabilities, so who cares? But then you say, well, you should look more carefully at that phase factor, because that phase factor, if you look at it, involves an exponential of a term which is, involves the time cubed, times the mass and the square of the gravitational acceleration field. And so this is a little bit of trouble because you've got the time cubed in there, this means that you actually have a different vacuum. So the two cases are a different vacuum. If you did a Fourier decomposition, look at positive and negative frequency splittings and all that, sure, it's a different vacuum. So this means you have a different quantum field theory. Again, you might say, who cares? As long as you stick to your vacuum, stick to your same quantum field theory, you're not going to be in trouble. Okay, now I'm going to change the situation. So instead of having simply looking at the Earth's gravitational field, I'm supposing that in the middle of my quantum situation up there, I have a mass which gets displaced into a superposition of two locations. So at the bottom, we see this mass in its superposition, it's blue state or its brown state have to be superposed because that's part of the system. It gets pushed into the superposition of two locations. Now you have to worry seriously because at each little point, you have the gravitational fields are in superposition. It looks as though your local picture of what the vacuum should be is different, and you are in trouble. You're stuck. Yes, you are stuck. But my view, if you want to take Einstein seriously, you're stuck. But what I'm doing is to try and cheat a little bit. So what I'm doing by cheating is to say, well, let's take this term and regard this thing as a bit of an error. And I'm integrating that error over the whole space. It's really more like this. Here I have a space-time picture of the acceleration field of a lump. And these little blue arcs represent the free fall of the field. And so the thing is, you're supposed to be taking that seriously. But when you have a lump which is in superposition of two locations, then the free fall is different. And so you have to take the difference and you look at that troublesome term and you integrate it all over whole space. And that is what I regard as the sort of error term or an uncertainty term of the whole thing. It works out, you just do an integration of their parts and you find there's an uncertainty in the energy of the system as a whole. And then I use the Heisenberg time energy uncertainty principle to predict a lifetime for that superposed state. So I say it's a bit like an unstable nucleus. That unstable nucleus has an uncertainty in its mass energy, and that uncertainty is reciprocally related to its lifetime. So I'm using the same picture as that. It's a bit like an unstable, that superposition is like an unstable particle because its energy is uncertain due to this puzzle between the trying to make the two great theories of 20th century physics fit together. The picture I get is the same as basically something that Dioshi had found earlier. That is to say, he also regarded the reciprocal of this. Well, you can interpret this energy uncertainty as the self-energy of the difference between the expectation values of the two mass distributions. So you have two mass distributions, you subtract one from the other, work out the gravitational self-energy of that difference, that is the EG, it's H cross over EG, which is the lifetime, with maybe some constant, which maybe of order unity, one would hope, but I don't know. That's not totally clear. There may be some constant there. Anyway, both Dioshi and I had this similar picture. He had it before I did, I had this particular motivation for it, actually originally a somewhat different motivation, but I think this one is rather stronger than the motivation I had before. So it tells you that superpositions ought to have this lifetime. Now, Dioshi took the model in a different direction, which is in the line of sort of CSL models and things, where you expect to see a heating of bodies. With my picture, I don't expect to see a heating, and I'll come to try and explain that in a moment. Here we just see, just for a uniform, this is the easy calculation you can do, for a uniform sphere, and then you imagine that uniform sphere being displaced into a superposition of two locations, and I guess 2b is the difference between the centers. And at the bottom, we see a graph. As you move it apart, how big does the EG get? Well, the main effect, it's about two-thirds of it, is up from coincidence to contact, and then you get another one-third more or so as you go right out to infinity. So that's more or less, but you might as well separate if you want to do an experiment. And let me, yes. Now the next picture here is a space-time picture. This is a serious picture now. I'm considering that we have such a model where you take a lump, like the one I just showed you, you put it into a superposition of two locations, and then after a certain length of time, it becomes one or the other. So that's the picture. And this is a space-time picture, time going up the picture. And when you have a solid line, that is the lump is in one location. When you have the broken line, the lump is in a superposition of two locations. And so what we imagine is that it becomes at the point Q star on one side or Q on the other, well, it becomes at Q star. It reduces and becomes at Q star. Now you see, I want to try and make this picture relativistically invariant. And you can try to make it so by looking at an observer moving with a great speed past this situation, and say the A observer would be moving to the left with a speed comparable with the speed of light. And those are the simultaneity slices for that observer. And for that observer, you would see that there would be a time, A1, when the particle or the body has been completely in the location, well, Q star location, and has not yet disappeared from the other one. So there is still a probability that it might still be there, and there might be two particles appearing. The observer on the other, the B observer moving the other way, it's the other way around. There's a point where location where the B2 simultaneity situation, then Q1 has disappeared altogether, but Q1 still might be, is a superposition of still being there and not there, and so it might disappear again, so they might both disappear. That's of course complete nonsense. That can't be what happens. You might imagine that the fading away is gradual. This has more trouble as well. I'll describe the trouble with that. It can't fade away gradually. That doesn't work. And I try to explain that later on. But let's take the full view that it does somehow disappear instantaneously or what. The only way to make relativistic sense of it is that it disappears at the point O, where they've started to separate. And that is my view. Now that's a very strange picture, but let me try and make that view make some more sense. By moving on to this picture, this is a little bit more what I think is going on. The bottom, we have a laser and high energy photon hitting a beam splitter. The laser is split into being reflected downwards or transmitted horizontally. If it goes horizontally, it hits this lump, it bashes into the lump, and then it displaces it. It starts moving it slightly to the left. Now, that is to say, it will be start moving to the left plus not moving. So it's in a superposition of two locations. If the photon goes down, it doesn't move. If it hits it, it does move. Now here I have a picture of the space-time. It's got a little bit of a kink in it representing the location of the lump. As we move upwards, that's time. It starts to bifurcate, the space-time bifurcates into two locations, and then zap, one of them disappears. But this picture is what I call the picture of a quantum reality. So the quantum reality, as I've got the words up here, represent the two of them together. Whereas the classical reality goes right back to the beginning. So you have to say that when one of them disappears, the real space-time really goes back to where the bifurcation took place originally. So the space-time is pretty continuous. There's no jump. So that you don't have the heating mechanism that most of these theories seem to suggest you have. It's retroactive in this way. So the picture I want you to get used to is that somehow classical reality maintains this pretty well continuous, there may be slight fluctuations of Planck scale sort of thing, but never mind about that. It pretty well continuously moves in this one thing where it forgets about this other branch altogether. Now that's a pretty strange picture, but let me move on and talk about classical reality and quantum reality. There are different kinds of reality, which I think one has to face up to. I have these notes which I sent out to people about all this, and it was only quite towards the end that I began to realize you had to have these two different kinds of realities. So I started rewriting it and it got a great mess. And then I got a Nobel Prize and that sort of got in the way and I stopped writing it. But I have to go back to it at some stage. Okay, what's classical reality? Classical reality has this feature that you can ask of a system. You can ask the system, what is your state? And the system can say, yes, my state is X. You say, what is the space-time like? How curved is it or something like that? And it can say, yes, I'm this much curved. What about quantum reality? Quantum reality is different. It doesn't give you an answer like that. Well, you might have a theory which tells you what you think the reality should be, and this tells you what kind of a measurement to make on the system. And you think this measurement, according to your theory, tells you that if the state is X, it will answer, yes, my state is X with certainty. So you will say, with certainty, yes, my state is with X. If you had it wrong, it might say, yes, my state is X, or it might say the state is not X. So you have to do the experiment many, many times to see what the quantum reality is. But in principle, you could find out what the quantum reality is by repeating the situation many, many times. Now, what I call quantum reality is really what I call Einstein's dictum. You see, Einstein proposed this. See, I think if I can read it. If without disturbing a system in any way, you can make a measurement and with certainty, you get the answer yes or something like this. So you can read what I said better than I can. So Einstein made this statement in 1935. So it's more or less saying that if you think you know what the state should be and you can make a measurement to say, is your state that, it will answer yes with certainty. And so it has a kind of reality, definite kind of reality, but it's not as strong as the classical reality. So I think it's important to have these two different pictures. Okay, let me move on. Quantum reality, I think, makes sense. I only looked at it for this is the standard Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen situation, where it's time is again going up the picture. At the bottom, we have the spin zero state, which splits into two spin halves. And we have Alice on the left, on Bob on the right, and maybe they're several light hours apart. That's quite important for what I want to say in a minute. Now you see, then Alice makes a measurement at the point MA, and she happens to choose some direction off, somewhere off a little bit to the right, and she gets the answer no. And then Bob somewhat later makes his measurement. Now you see the quantum reality is mapped out on here. The state at the beginning is just the spin zero state. When I say after, Alice makes her measurement, it's after in a strange sense. It's after her past light cone. You have to go, I think this is, other people have come to this conclusion too. Maybe it was Dioshi, I can't remember now, who came to the same conclusion that there is a reality to the state along the past light cone. It's a rather curious kind of retroactive reality. Nevertheless, that's the way it seems to work, because you could have observers moving with very great speed and you could see it, that this has to be the case, that if you have some reality determined in the Einsteinian sense by Alice's measurement, that will project backwards to this point QB, which I marked down here. And so that the state which Bob later measures is this one? It doesn't, since he has no idea what the, not just what the answer she gets is, but he has no idea what measurement direction she's chosen. I mean, they might have agreed this ahead of time, sure. But if she's, I'll come to that in a minute. But anyway, you see there is the quantum. It's a bit strange, but as far as I can see, it's consistent. I haven't tried it with more. You can have, you know, maybe a, one of these three particle situations like the Zeilinger et al. Situation, and maybe you can work out a picture of the quantum reality there. I haven't done it. It would be interesting to see. As far as I can make out, it is a consistent picture of the world, but it's also strangely retroactive, not in the same way of the classical thing which I showed you before. Now I do want to, I think this is maybe my last slide. There is a thing that Sandro Donadi emailed me at one point with an interesting idea, a very interesting idea. Let me go back to perhaps to the Alice and Bob situation. Let us suppose that the measuring, you see, when you make a measurement on either side, it might be because you're trying to, I mean, every measurement according to the CSL type schemes or my type of scheme, where the measurement is meant to be movement of a mass in some sense, and that is a physical thing, and that it's a real thing in the world. It's not something which happens somehow subjectively. It's a real objective phenomenon. And does this, what am I trying to say here? The objective picture is given in this scheme here. But let's suppose that Alice tries to send a message to Bob, which is not the result of her measurement. We know we can't do that. But suppose she chooses the angle of her measurement in such a way that she can send to Bob in the few light hours that she has, faster than light, a certain signal, because Bob will receive a message which is a certain amplitude for his spin direction to be, it'll be, I mean, if it's, because she's made a measurement and his, in a certain direction, his measurement over here will be an amplitude superposition between the opposite direction and that direction. And can he tell by the length of time it takes to reduce, I mean, does the length of time it takes to reduce depend on the amplitudes? And this was what Donadi was suggesting. And he was suggesting that that's going to land you in trouble. And I think he's right. It does land you in trouble. But I went a little bit further than that because it seems to indicate that Alice could send a signal of what her direction is if Bob's measurement did depend on the time. That is to say, if the ratio of the amplitudes did influence the light time. So here I've got an indication of this. You see, suppose Bob receives this angled spin, and we say it's alpha times up and time plus beta times down, or beta bar plus this kind of thing. And those are the two alternative possibilities that he might measure if he chose the same whatever direction he, so the question is, can he tell by the length of time that it takes to collapse what the ratio of alpha to beta is? And this argument is to show that he can't. I mean, if he could, then Alice could send a message to Bob. I simply, you do the experiment many, many times, which you can maybe do within that hour that you've got, do the experiment many, many times, and you could work out if there was any influence on the length of time that the state reduces by the ratio of these amplitudes, then you'd be in trouble. So there can't be. The trouble is that I see in this is that if you have something like a CSL model where the you judge, it's what you call gambler's ruin. I think this was an idea due to Philip Pearl originally. You have the amplitudes of your state, alpha and beta, they wiggle around and they wiggle around and wiggle around until one of them becomes so much bigger than the other that you consider that the state is reduced. But the trouble with that is that it reduces more quickly if alpha and beta are very different from each other than if they're almost the same as each other. So then it seems to me by looking at the length of time to wait for the reduction of the state to happen, you would be able to tell what Alice's angle was. And so I think this is very troublesome for models of this kind. So that is a point I wanted to make. Okay. Now you see, I was asked, can you design an experiment to test this retroactive view I have? And this was my experiment. I'm not quite sure what it tests. You can form your own view about this. But I think it is troublesome for many things like CSL models. I'm not sure. Here we have, oh, I wish I could bring that into the middle. Never mind. On the left-hand side, you see a laser. It shoots a high-energy photon along, which reaches, now that moved. How did that happen? So it's half, beam splitter. Goes through, half goes up, half goes horizontally. Now the horizontal part hits a little mirror. This little mirror has a little catch attached to it, and this little catch releases a mass. So this mass starts to fall. So you can see there's a little catch there, and the mass starts to fall. Maybe there's a little loss of the momentum for the photon there. So I compensate that by putting a little spring on the vertical part. So that if all things being similar, forgetting about the big lump, just the fact that maybe there was a little bit of reduction in the energy in the photon comes together and I arrange it so that they coherently come together and find their way right back. Oh, I wish I could, yes. So after it comes, yes. It coherently combines and comes back horizontally to the beam splitter. So the detector way down at the bottom doesn't see anything. So that's what you'd expect. It doesn't see anything. But now suppose this mass drops down, and as it drops down, well, you see it only drops down if the mirror has been hit. It doesn't drop down if the mirror hasn't been hit. So it's a superposition of dropping down and not dropping down. And so, okay, maybe it will reduce the state during its flight downwards. And then it will mean, okay, I've been hit. You see, if it reduces the state, that means it's been hit. That means the horizontal beam coming back to the beam splitter will have been reduced. And it's either there or it's not there. And therefore, as it meets the beam splitter, there is 50% chance that the detector right at the bottom will see it. So if there is a reduction, if there's a measurement made, which is made either by a lump being seen by being reducing itself, or by whatever means, in my next slide, I hope I can see the next one. Is it happening automatically? See, if it sees it early, this is sort of schematic. See, maybe it will happen to see it before the detector sees it, or it happens afterwards. If it sees it before the detector sees it, then it's still in a superposed state, and so therefore the detector won't see it at the bottom. If the mass has moved far enough that the detector will see it later on, then, I don't know. I would be very interested to know what standard quantum mechanics says here. I think standard quantum mechanics says more or less the same as what the retroactive picture says, but it's a little bit strange to see. The retroactive picture says that as long as the reduction of the mass has happened before you see it, before the detector at the bottom sees it, then it will see it. If it happens afterwards, well, it has 50% chance of seeing it. If it doesn't, I think I'll just give this experiment to somebody to think about. And I think it's an intriguing idea what ordinary quantum mechanics would say or what various CSL models would say in this situation. As far as I know, the CSL models, when they look at experiments, they only look at the heating effect. It would be very interesting actually to look at a serious reduction of the state. I know that Dirk Burmeister has been trying to do an experiment of this type for many years. Many years. There are other experiments which are in the planning stage, which either using little tiny particles or using Bose-Einstein condensates, the latter, which I think would be a very exciting idea to use. Anyway, let me stop at this point and sorry to have had all this difficulty with the PowerPoint for one reason or another.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you so much for the great talk, and for giving a PowerPoint talk, which I know is a.
You can see how bad at it I am.
How about questions? Ghazal, I know you had a question earlier on. Do you still have
is
that question?
Is anybody still there? I'm glad to have questions from them, yes.
Hello, thank you for your talk. I just wanted to go back to the earlier part of your talk about this eon cosmology.
Sure.
I'm a little bit confused trying to make some kind of physics intuition about how it's going. I mean, I can understand from the space-time perspective, maybe the future of one eon is cold, but then from the observer in the new eon, maybe you start in a Big Bang and a hot universe. But is that the right picture that I have?
What's so troublesome to people, and I agree with this, yeah, is to imagine that the universe, which seems at first sight so different, in the remote future, you have very, very cold, very rarefied, and it doesn't seem anything like a Big Bang, where you've got huge density and temperature, and what could be more different, you say? But if you'd only had massless things, that's the hard thing to get your mind around. But if it were photons, suppose the physics were just electromagnetism, you wouldn't know the difference. Because Maxwell's theory, you can stretch and squash, and as I say, the stretching and squashing can be non-uniform. It doesn't have to be an overall scale. You can stretch in one place and more and squash in other places more. And the Maxwell field doesn't notice the difference. Now, I think this is a uniform feature of very, very high temperatures, if you like. And so, I mean, it depends on the theory, but it's not unreasonable, at least, to suppose that the mass in its effect disappears when you have, or that the mass asymptotically goes to zero by comparison with any other energies. And so effectively, you're looking at massless things. It's not like the physics we know, but then the physics we know isn't like what it's like at the extremely early stages of the Big Bang.
Okay, so is that like all the planets or galaxies in the far future or?
They would all be black holes. You see, if you think of very far future, what's happened? Well, okay, most of the mass is concentrated in galactic clusters. Most of that gets swallowed by black holes. So you have a big, super massive black hole. That eventually evaporates away, mainly through photons. Of course, they will be at the very far end, you'll get some other particles. So it's mainly photons. So it's mainly photons. You do have things like hydrogen running around and maybe some odd, I don't know, some loose electrons, and I guess you get plasma, and I don't quite know what happens in the remote future for plasma. You'll get magnetic fields. Magnetic fields can come through without any trouble. It would be very interesting to see whether you could see magnetic fields coming through. I think that's another test of this theory, which I'd be very interested if someone could see, because magnetic fields in plasma might well be seen, and you could see it concentrated maybe with the Hawking points, because they would be where there used to be a cluster of galaxies, and then you would have a magnetic fields hanging around. They wouldn't have time to escape because the speed of light isn't fast enough to get away with the expansion of the universe. It all gets conformally squashed down into a little point. I agree it's hard to get your mind around. It does depend on the physics being dominated by conformally invariant physics in the Big Bang, and being the fact that the mass fades out in the remote future. The latter being the bigger assumption, I think.
So I guess, yeah, I understand. Your point is the black holes will filter out the mass into photons, most of it.
Yeah, they just go into photons mainly, yes. So that's, most of the mass would be, actually, when I say most, I'm not quite sure how much is in hydrogen, because there's a lot running around. But then the hydrogen, you see, if the mass fades out, the hydrogen would separate, eventually come apart. And then does the proton decay? Well, that maybe it does, into positrons or something, neutrinos. Well, neutrinos, they've got a little bit of a mass. I don't know. So it's hard to know. But the hypothesis would be that you run out of mass. And then you run out of the ability to tell big from small. You can't make a thing which would measure how big it is. That would be the idea. You could imagine, you know, have some space capsule which is supposed to be made so rigid that it won't have trouble. But then it would start to evaporate away, and it would lose its rigidity. And that would be the picture. Yeah. I mean, it could be wrong. Sure, it could be wrong. But it does have, you see, unlike other schemes, I should have made the point that inflation, for example, you see, what about the scale invariance of the microwave background, the temperature variations in the microwave background, which is what the main, I guess, the main reason for keeping inflation, I think, because you want to have something which does that. But then you see you have to have the dark matter in the scheme. The dark matter has to decay. There is dark matter automatically in the scheme. I should have said that. The equations force this. There is a dark matter. See, originally it's just a cosmological constant in the previous eon. But when you cross over to the next one, you have to turn the conformal factor into its reciprocal. And this effect has the effect of producing a lot of scalar material, which only interacts gravitationally. So the hypothesis is that it's dark matter. It has to decay away throughout the eon, so it's all gone at the end. And the decay of the dark matter would be into gravitational signals. And these gravitons would be things which would influence the CMB of the next eon. A lot of this hasn't been worked out properly. I'm just saying that what I think the scheme would have other implications. The most immediate next one would be magnetic fields, primordial magnetic fields associated with the Hawking points. So you'd see them in the same places. You might see magnetic fields elsewhere for other reasons. What else?
Should we?
Other questions?
Oh yeah, I was going to ask Kasia, I think you were next. Do you have a question?
Actually, not trying not to.
I think you're muted, Kasia. No, we can't hear you. You're not muted, but for some reason we can't hear you anyway.
And now?
Yes, now.
Roger, you're not the only person who has difficulties with Zoom. This is universal. So,
I thought it was mainly due to old age.
No, not at all. It's generational.
Anyway, you have a question other than this.
Yes. So I want to actually follow up on what Ghazal asked. What is exactly the mechanism for, you know, transitioning from one eon to another? Because I have this picture that the mass is fading away and now you have something which is completely conformal, but then somehow where is the point where you start the next cycle? Is there like a physical mechanism that is driving this sort of change of perspective?
Well, the point is really infinity. You see, you do the conformal map, which makes infinity finite. And then the procedure you have is to replace the conformal factor by minus its inverse. Now, the thing is, you have to have what I regard as the bandage metric. So there is a region which joins the remote future of one eon into the early part of the next eon. And you have an intermediate metric, which is the bandage metric. And you can translate from the remote future metric to the bandage metric quite smoothly. And then the bandage metric has its equations to carry you across from one eon to the next. And then you revert to the physical metric from the bandage metric, which is the minus the inverse of the one you had before. And this introduces dark matter, and it changes the universe to very small from very big. But you have to have equations which govern the evolution during the bandage.
Right.
But the bandage, you see, the argument is that in the overlap between the bandage phase and the remote future, it's the physics is completely unchanged. I mean, it's just two patches, two descriptions of the same physics. Mm-hmm. And on along the bandage, you can continue where the conformal factor now goes through zero. And you can make sense of that. And going through zero, you can then continue it onto the other side. Mm-hmm. So you get equations. All I can say is you have equations which take you over from one side to the other. So if you call that a mechanism or not, I'm not sure. It's equations.
Sure. Yeah, I was wondering what's kind of the physics behind it. So can you determine the form, the exact form of this bandage metric from experiment or at least thought experiment? I mean, is it purely mathematical at this point, or is there some physical mechanism that determines what's going on in that transition period?
I think I would have to confess at this point that there is some lack of, what would I say? I have various colleagues. Paul Todd was the first one to do this, and then I had a way of doing it. And Jörg Fraundiener in New Zealand has another way. And all these ways are slightly different from each other. So there are various hypotheses you have to make to fix the evolution. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there is one fundamental issue about fixing the evolution, which I've been trying to think about recently, because you have to lose some symmetry. Because the remote future is basically De Sitter space, and the De Sitter space has the De Sitter group for its symmetry. And you have to break that symmetry to be a group, depending on whether the space-time, the spatial metric is closed, flat, or hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. I know people say that it has to be flat, but I think the flatness more or less comes because people think inflation flattens it out. I don't have inflation. And so you could have all three geometries. It could be flat, it could be positive, it could be negative. I haven't made up my mind which I think I like the best. I have a hypothesis which I haven't seen what it implies yet. But you do have to lose symmetry, which is to do with choosing which of these geometries you take. And mm-hmm. that does mean introducing some extra feature to it. So it's not quite as smoothly carried across as one would not like. There is something, you can certainly do it to the extent of working out what the expectations would be in the next eon with regard to black hole evaporation. I think that's fairly unambiguous. The collisions between black holes is probably fairly ambiguous. The Hawking point. Well, there are these things which would, I'm not sure how ambiguous they are. I think the collisions between black holes is probably pretty unambiguous, yes.
Okay, thanks for the answer.
Right, it's a great answer, I'm afraid, but yes.
All right. Lee, I think, was next.
Lee? Hey, hi, Roger.
Hi, yes.
Roger, I want to ask you about time reversal invariance and breaking it, because you used to say at some point that, and you said it towards the beginning of your talk, that there was a problem keeping the initial entropy low, and you were going to resolve this by having quantum gravity be time asymmetric, so that there were...
Oh, the old idea, yeah. Which
yes.
I decided. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you see, that seems to get lost in the present picture, because there's just classical physics happening with the conformal cyclic cosmology.
I can tell you what, you see, I slightly changed my mind on what I think it is.
Okay.
I can tell you where the entropy goes.
Okay.
You see, in the remote future, the entropy is in the black holes almost entirely. I mean, that's not controversial. Okay. I mean, that's Bekenstein Hawking. Already, it's utterly, almost totally in the entropy, is almost totally in the black holes. There's a little bit which we worry about, but that falls into the black holes too. So it's almost entirely in black holes. Now, what happens to the black holes? They evaporate away. Some of it might get squashed into the singularity. Some of it might get taken away into the radiation. And I know Don Page had a sort of 50-50 argument. I used to think it had to be mostly in the singularity, but I think Don might well be right. And a lot of it is photons in the radiation, the Hawking evaporation. Now the Hawking evaporation all gets concentrated into the Hawking points. Now, when you cross over into the next eon, all that point is much, much smaller than the Planck distance. So the mass of that has to be preserved in a certain sense as you go across, because you can do integrals which have to be preserved as you go across. This comes from the smoothness of the continuation as you cross from one side to the other. So you can't get rid of the mass, but the mass, what it does, it presumably gets converted into energy, which is spewed out from that Hawking point. So I guess the entropy is largely lost at the Hawking point. It's swallowed into the Planck scale geometry of the Hawking point.
So you're not making an argument that that quantum gravity gets rid of the singularity and saves the information or the entropy.
No, it certainly doesn't do that. You mean this is some people who think it gets, it doesn't help. Yes, put it like that. There are those who say that the black hole information paradox thing. Yes,
the alleged
yes.
black hole information paradox.
Yes, which I regard as not a paradox, because after all, you're in such a gravitational situation as a black hole, I don't expect unitarity to be preserved. So I have no reason to preserve unitarity. And certainly if you look at the conformal diagram, you have a lot of trouble at the singularity close to it. You see, you've got the light cones all focusing into that singularity. And why should that information skid across space-like directions to escape? See, it doesn't actually matter in this scheme. I mean, I don't think it does get out. I don't see how that information can all escape into the radiation. Maybe some of it does, but I think you're violating the, what do they call it? The,
you don't mean the second law.
No. What's it, what people call it? The copying. Yeah, the copying.
No cloning theorem.
That's right. You're violating no cloning, because when you get right up to the singularity, you've still got stuff going on there, which is going to be swallowed by the singularity. And if that information is going to escape outside, you're violating no cloning.
Well, I think I'll let Carlo argue about that part with you. But
yes, I mean, it doesn't actually matter in my picture, because whether it's in the Hawking evaporation or whether it's in the singularity, it all comes into the Hawking point. And that Hawking point is less, much, much, much less than a Planck scale as it comes out onto the other side. Mm-hmm. Who knows what goes to the physics? All I can say is that the mass of it has to be preserved in some sense. Mm-hmm. Yet the information in it, which is presumably all in that Hawking evaporation, is either in the singularity or squelched out into nowhere, or it's in the Hawking evaporation, which is still squelched out into nowhere, because it's just in the Hawking point. And that is.
And after this, let me just the last quick thing. After this, you can assert that the very late time of the late universe is roughly conformally in time reversal equivalent to the Big Bang. That is, you're able to invoke time reversal symmetry as you go across.
No. Oh. Well, I mean, it doesn't. You see, it's the way the conformal factors is what behaves. It's just driven from one to the other. I mean, it's certainly not. What would I say? I mean, it's deliberately time asymmetric in that one has an infinite I mean, the metric conformal factor is to convert it into its into one over its inverse.
Right. So the infinite
mechanism
volume is broken down into very small volume. Okay.
Yes, I don't see. Certainly, the information gets squashed into the Hawking points, whether it's in the evaporation or in the singularity. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
I mean, that's too late. You see, it's way, way, way too late to have any equations, classical equations governing, because you're looking at all that energy is squashed into less than the Planck diameter.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you can, as I say, estimate how much mass there is in it, appropriately scaled. I mean, you've got to do the conformal scaling properly. And you do that, there's a certain invariant which carries across from one side to the other. So you don't lose that. But that will be spread out to this 4 degrees across the sky, 380,000 years to spread out, scattering like crazy, doing what Jim Peebles says it does and people. So I'm quite happy with that. And it doesn't escape until 380,000 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just sort of, I mean, maybe there's detailed structure in that. Someday people will discover some detailed structure which tells you what's really going on in the Hawking point. But as far as I can see, maybe neutrinos will be helpful. But I guess they got a better chance to escape. I don't really know. That's another possibility. You might see neutrinos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like we just have two last questions. Jacob, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. And thank you so much, Roger, for such a cool talk. I understand from your talk that the things in the universe that are more conformally invariant sort of dominate at late times. That's and I was wondering, I'm not totally sure if this makes sense as a question, but does the model support situations where things are approximately conformally invariant at the beginning and end of the universe, or is it necessary that things become perfectly conformally invariant at
the limit? I want them to be conformally invariant in the limit. You see, it's only that's in that sense in the Big Bang, see, because I'm only saying that the mass gets dominated by kinetic energy, and that's in the limit, the mass is irrelevant. So I guess I'm saying in that limit, as you go into the Big Bang, the conformal invariance of the physics is the limiting situation. And so I'm only saying probably in a similar sense in the remote future, there will be a limiting sense in which the conformal invariance, yes.
And then would that happen at a finite time or?
No, probably just, no, it just fades out.
Okay. Great,
I think that would be the view I would have. You know, it might be, you know, so small that it's totally insignificant at some finite time. But I think the view I would hold at the moment anyway is that it fades out, so that the conformal invariance is a limiting thing as time or as a conformal factor becomes zero or infinite or whatever, yes, whichever one you like to use, which is zero. little omega goes to zero, big omega goes to infinity. So yes, let's use little omega.
Okay, last question, Kevin.
Would you be so kind as to tell us what you think of inflation and the bouncing universe model?
Yes, well, you see, I've always been against inflation right from the start, partly through ignorance, I expect, because there are, well, I think the original reason was something to do with magnetic monopoles or something, which would have to be there for it to be useful. But it became, I suppose, the main reason for its survival. I mean, there's a wrong reason for its survival, which was that it was believed to smooth out the universe, and the universe being almost flat was the idea. But inflation simply doesn't do that, as far as I can see. I mean, the inflaton field doesn't do it, because if you take a generic collapsing model, like the sort of mess which I was showing you in the middle of my talk, that mess, inflaton field doesn't do a damn thing. it only works if you have something close to Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker. If it's close to that, then you can put inflation in, you can sort of fine tune everything to make it do what it's supposed to do, I suppose. But it always seemed to me an extremely artificial idea. And if you have another explanation for the scale invariance of the microwave background and another explanation for the smoothness of the universe, then I don't think you want inflation. Because inflation is roped in, you invent the inflaton field purely for inflation. It used to be, I think in the old days, it used to be something else, but it wasn't, turned out not to be. I forget what it was. But the inflaton field is only put in there for inflation. And it messes up my model completely, because if you put inflation in, it would split one eon from the next to a huge effect and you wouldn't see a damn thing. So I would consider that these observations, A, of the Hawking points, B, of the rings, which I claim are significantly there. I think the Vahe-Gözajan didn't do it that way, but the analysis, the Polish people, when they looked, they got not so much a strong confidence level, but I think it was 99.94% confidence, which is, you know, pretty significant. There's something going on. They were looking completely different way for these rings. So I think there's evidence both for the rings and for the Hawking points. And if you had inflation, it would mess them both up completely, because it would increase the gap between the turn off, or at least the remote future of the previous eon and the Big Bang, or let's say turn off of inflation moment, because in the inflation simply spreads that out by a huge factor and you wouldn't see a damn thing. So I think the Hawking point observations are a big challenge to inflation. I haven't seen anybody take it seriously. For both of these signals, I've seen people do an analysis and not see it. Now, to my mind, not seeing the effect is not terribly impressive. You find a way of analyzing the data which doesn't see it, rather than saying that the way it has, the analysis has been done, which does show the data, is wrong. That has not been shown. What has been shown is that there are ways of not seeing the data, not seeing the signals. Sure. That doesn't mean anything to me.
And about Paul Steinhardt's bouncing universes?
Oh, well, that doesn't work here either, you see, because any, I mean, what are you going to do with the black holes? Which you say Holstein? What?
Paul Steinhardt.
Paul Steinhardt, sorry. No, I know. I don't see how you're going to make that work, because you can't make it bounce until after the black holes have all gone. Otherwise, you're in real trouble, because the black holes will wreck it. They will produce signals in the background which you don't see. It depends how long. See, if you've got, I mean, they wanted a trillion years or something, didn't they?
I can't remember.
They may have changed. I don't know what the latest model is. But the trouble is, it's not doing something like my scheme. If you don't wait long enough for the black holes to evaporate, then they'll be there already. And they'll be making a big mess of the bounce. In fact, there's a big mess in the bounce anyway, because the irregularities in the universe will cause irregularities. I don't quite see how to make it work. Maybe they have ways around that. I haven't studied the details of what they've done most recently. I can't see how it would. I don't think change. You see, bounce is a problem, right? Going right back to Friedman and all these things. If you've got an arrow of time, which is the entropy, then you've got to reverse it in the middle somehow. And I don't know how you do that, especially if you've got black holes around. They don't like reversing themselves. Black holes like to carry on right through. you've got to have some drastic physics to turn a black hole around.
Thank you.
Okay, well, so I think that we've run out of questions, and in view of time, I think we should thank Roger one more time for giving us a talk over Zoom and for a great talk.